International Kabul Airport.
The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack.
Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country. More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues the tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. "We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims." Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
"Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. the livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was, Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
The Israeli regime is a sworn enemy of regional power Iran, and it makes no secret of its animosity towards the Islamic Republic, which is leading a regional front against the occupying force. The regime has assassinated several top Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran and is widely believed to have carried out sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities, which operate under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Israel has recently escalated its anti-Iran rhetoric. This week, the regime renewed military threats against the Islamic Republic. The Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, issued a new threat against Iran's nuclear facilities. Gantz said Israel has the means to act alone and would not hesitate to strike Iran. He made the threat after once again accusing Tehran of orchestrating a recent drone attack on an Israeli-linked oil tanker last month. The Mercer Street was sailing in the sea off Oman on July 29th when it was struck. Iran has denied any involvement in that attack, but Tel Aviv is apparently using the naval incident as a pretext to rally its regional and Western allies against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who is currently in the United States, is also trying to persuade the Americans to avoid diplomacy with Iran. The Israeli premier insisted that clandestine operations against Iran's nuclear program would not stop.
It's meant to create tension, and it is meant to try to push the Biden administration into disavowing negotiations with Iran. I'm quite sure that those negotiations will go on, even if, discreetly, even if there is a public avowal to support Israeli security.
Bennett seems to be on a mission in the U.S., pushing U.S. President Joe Biden to get tougher on Iran. Soon after arrival in the U.S., Bennett doubled down on his threats against Iran. Will that affect America's stance? The U.S. president has already refused to lift any of the sanctions that his predecessor imposed on Iran after unilaterally leaving the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Biden was a vociferous critic of Donald Trump's Iran policy, but after several months into his presidency, he is still refusing to change America's course. Biden's stance has seriously undermined the prospect of a return to the 2015 nuclear deal, as Iran insists that the U.S. sanctions must be removed before the deal is restored. Meanwhile, the Iranians have made it clear that any attack on Iran would be met with ultimate force. Just recently, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warned that a mistake on the part of the regime would lead to its collapse. Major General Hossein Salami said the stage has been set for Israel's collapse in any future war.
It would defend itself with all of the military might it can muster. And in the case of Iran, that's quite a bit. And that is, again, why I say it is obvious to me, and should be obvious to most observers, that the United States does not want to get drawn into that type of a situation. I do believe that Israel fully understands that any attack against Iran would be a serious blowback to itself.
The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for instability in the region and beyond.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. In this episode, you will be listening to the Imam's viewpoints on the duties of the lawmakers and the responsibility of the nation and the body for vetting the qualification of lawmakers, guardian council, toward parliamentarian elections. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, with much care, scrutinizes the role of Parliament in the country and writes in his testament, "Among the important affairs is the commitment of the members of the Islamic Council Assembly. We saw what calamitous damages Islam and Iran suffered from the unrighteous and deviated Parliament since the post-constitutional era till the era of the criminal Pahlavi regime, and worse and more dangerous than any time during this imposed corrupt regime, and what destructive catastrophes and damages were inflicted on the country and nation by these worthless and servile criminals. During these 50 years, a bogus, deviated minority against an innocent majority caused Britain and the Soviet Union, and recently the U.S., to do whatever they wish through these very deviants and drag the country to decadence and destruction. Since the post-constitutional era, the important clauses of the Constitution had never been put into effect. Before Reza Khan, this was due to the vestoxicated and a handful of Khans and land feudalists, and during the Pahlavi era, by the bloodthirsty regime and its lackeys and vassals." Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "Now with God's grace and the effort of the grand nation, the country's fate has been put in people's hands, and the lawmakers are from the people and have entered the parliament with their election without the intervention of government and Khans of regions. And we hope that with their commitment to Islam and the country's interest, any deviation would be prevented. I recommend to the nation, for the present time and future, with their firm resolve and commitment to the Islamic laws and the interests of the country, in every round of parliamentarian election, send lawmakers who are devoted to Islam and the Islamic Republic, which are mostly among the middle and deprived classes of society and not deviated from the right path toward the West or the East, and have no inclination toward deviated schools, but rather educated persons and aware of the affairs of the time and Islamic policies." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "Now that, thank God, the barriers have been removed and the free space has been created for involvement of all classes, no excuse remains, and it is among the great unforgivable sins to be insouciant toward the affairs of Muslims. everyone should be at the service of Islam and the country to the extent of his ability and influence to seriously prevent the penetration of the adherents of the two colonialist poles, the westoxicated or istoxicated and the deviants from the great school of Islam. And they should know that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic countries, which are the very international plundering superpowers, gradually and subtly infiltrate in our country and Islamic countries and drag these countries to the trap of exploitation by the persons of the same nations. Then the Imam, addressing the ulema and the sources of emulation, writes, "And I recommend the respectable clergy community, especially the great sources of emulation, not to keep aloof from the affairs of society, particularly the presidential and parliamentary elections, and not to be indifferent. All of you saw, and the future generation will hear, that the hands of players of politics, following the East and the West, set aside the ulema who had founded the constitutional movement with much effort. While the ulema too were fooled by players of politics and considered involvement in the affairs of the country and Muslims as out of their position. Thus, they gave the sin to the westoxicated and let the constitutional movement, the constitution itself, and the country to sustain damages which need long time to compensate." Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "I ask and recommend the respectable Guardian Council, either in the present generation or the next ones, to fulfill their Islamic and national duties with full care and power and not to be impacted by any power, and with no consideration to prevent the laws that are opposed to the pure religion and the constitution. And I ask the members of the Islamic Council Assembly Parliament in the present era and the next eras that, if God forbid, some deviated elements with conspiracies in political play impose their membership unto the people, the assembly should reject their credentials and not let a sabotaging affiliated element enter the parliament." The Imam also, addressing the religious minorities, writes, "I recommend the official religious minorities to take lesson from the eras of the Pahlavi regime and choose their MPs from among the persons who are committed to their religion and the Islamic Republic and not affiliated to world-devouring powers and have no inclination to atheist and deviated schools."
Sky may be the only place you can find peace in Afghanistan, because from up here, bad incidents become so small that they're not visible anymore. If the only criterion is people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. The incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. From New York to Kabul.
Part 1.
If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back two decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. Two decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year.
Moments later, the president walked in. That was interesting.
On September 11th, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school. His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. Four suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 fact-finding commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. September 13, 2001. 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
These almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
All the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar. The false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else, to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye, leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund Al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or Al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. Hundreds of dead and wounded was the result of Daesh presence in Afghanistan.
Why was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time that this was all, that all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances, and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire U.K. military budget and more than the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military, the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind, gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons. AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who could say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded, has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
Look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of the mines and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's In other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince and let him make billions of dollars off of it? That way the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, it hasn't gotten, I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to pay, to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952. And we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and said, and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see, but if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the use of crying and mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein after 1400 years? Why are you disseminating sadness, crying and tears among people? They complain. This is not sadness and tears for the sake of sadness and tears. This is for the sake of the values. The things that lie behind the lamentation, beating the chest and the head, and shedding tears are the dearest things that one might find in the treasure trove of humanity. And they are the divine spiritual values. The Shia are trying to uphold the fact that Hussein ibn Ali is the epitome of all these values. The Shia are trying to keep their memories alive. And if the Muslim Ummah keeps Imam Hussein's name and memory alive and follows him, it will overcome all the obstacles and the hardships. And that is why all of us in the Islamic Revolution, in the Islamic Republic, from the highest to the lowest echelons, including the people, the authorities, the senior officials, and our honorable Imam, have relied on the issue of Imam Hussein and the issue of Ashura and people's mourning. The mourning has a symbolic as well as a realistic aspect. It binds hearts together and it broadens knowledge.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
I would like to discuss a point regarding the efforts to promote Islam in the month of Muharram. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This is why Imam Khomeini recommended the traditional forms of mourning. The Quranic verses about the role of the infallible Imams are interpreted in three different ways. Vilayat is one of these interpretations. Your guardian can only be Allah and His messenger, and those who believe, who establish worship and pay charity, and bow down in prayer. The Holy Quran, chapter 5, verse number 55. Another interpretation is submission and obedience. Obey Allah and obey the Messenger and those in authority from among you. The Holy Quran, chapter 4, verse number 59.
Young and old, men and women from all walks of life have gathered on the outskirts of Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, to commemorate Yom-e Hussein, or the Day of Imam Hussein. This is one of the events organized across Kashmir Valley every year during the Muslim calendar month of Muharram to discuss the significance of Imam Hussein's sacrifice to uphold Islamic teachings, truth and justice. The event brings together more than 100 Islamic scholars from different parts of Kashmir.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
The scholars urge the youth to go deep into the pages of Islamic history to understand the sacrifices Imam Hussein made.
Imam Hussein, Muharram and Karbala have a message, and we have come to promote that message. The events of Karbala teaches us to be steadfast. They teach us the values of sacrifice for truth. They teach us not to give up and not to bow down. They teach us how Imam Hussein and his companions won the battle of Karbala, despite losing their lives. Today, 1400 years have passed, and we have carried the events of Karbala in our hearts and will carry it to our younger generation and won't let anyone forget the greatest sacrifice for the humanity.
The Islamic scholars also reminded people of plots being hatched by enemies of Islam and urged Muslims to stay united.
The enemies of Islam intend to divide us across communal lines. The majority of non-Muslims think Shias and Sunnis are at odds. They call Shia Muslims Husseinis and Sunni Muslims Mohammedans. And this is deliberate. It is aimed at creating a rift among Muslims to divide us, to divide our faith. Hussein alayhi salam is Prophet Muhammad's grandson. So how come we are divided? Such conferences aim to enlighten people about the nefarious designs of enemies and to teach the importance of unity among Muslims.
Religious scholars say the Battle of Karbala was a defining moment in the history of Islam that continues to inspire people regardless of their religion. And the real tribute to the martyrs of Karbala would be to follow their path in letter and spirit. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday.
He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty, and independence in our world. We lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights.
Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
In a press conference, Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip declared the return of nighttime protests, also known as night confusion operations along the buffer zone, to reject the Israeli blockade on the enclave.
It is time to end this crippling siege completely. We gave the mediators many chances to end this siege, and there are no more chances for any delay. Our people have got enough of the suffering. We will not leave our positions and won't stop the confrontation until Israel ends the blockade. Israeli settlers nearby won't witness peace as long as our people are not living in peace. We won't stay silent over the misery our people live in.
Palestinian protesters staged a demonstration near the buffer zone, burning tires and launching incendiary balloons at the Israeli army. The demonstrators were voicing their anger at the deteriorating quality of life in the Gaza Strip, caused by a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. On Saturday, 13-year-old Omar Hassan Abu Nil died of injuries after being shot by the Israeli soldiers during an anti-Israeli protest held a week before.
If the Israeli regime keeps committing these crimes against our people, we will continue the fight and confront the regime here. Israel should know that we are only fighting for our right to live a decent life. This is our land, and we won't leave it, no matter the cost.
Palestinian Resistance Front says it will escalate clashes with Israel as long as the regime keeps its suffocating siege on Gaza, hampering life in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
State security forces on standby in Washington, D.C. were activated today as Palestinians marched toward the White House to condemn the first meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. That's